Welcome to the IF Podcast. My name is Natalie Hopkinson. I'm a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation, and today we will have a wide-ranging discussion about the role of student voice in the future of education. The Interactivity Foundation and Wesleyan College recently launched a two-year collaboration to implement student-centered discussion processes in the classroom. So today we have a room full of guests to talk about all of these ideas. Joining us is Allison Brown, an education lawyer based in Washington. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you, Natalie.
And we have Jeff Prudhomme, Vice President of the Interactivity Foundation, who recently returned from Macon, Georgia to kick off the IF collaboration with Wesleyan College.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone from Macon, Georgia, we have Matt Martin, who's Knox Professor of English and a professor of the humanities from Wesleyan College. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Natalie.
So the overarching theme today is voice. Jeff, could you talk a little bit about the foundation's approach to student-centered learning?
We had begun to think in 2009, what would it be like if students had this as their first college experience? So if one of their first courses was one where they were asked to be co-discoverers and developers of the course content in teams of their fellow students that they themselves took turns in facilitating, and facilitating in a way that would expand the perspectives they considered and the possibilities they developed. So we had in mind to do this as part of our next summer institute, which would be this upcoming summer in 2012. And lo and behold, we had one of our alumni, Matt, coming from our 2009 group of faculty, who approached us saying, "Hey, I'd really like to train the other faculty who teach in our first year program how to do this." So we sensed we had a good match, and we decided, instead of bringing people together from all different schools, let's try to look at one particular school and their distinctive approach to the first year program and see if we could implement this in all their first semester, first year courses.
So Matt, that's where you come in. Could you talk a little bit about what your experience was like at the first IF Summer Institute, and was that any way a departure from the way that you traditionally teach your English courses and humanities courses?
I really enjoyed the time I was able to spend at Madison with the IF Summer Institute. It was a great opportunity to be able to talk with a really excellent team of faculty from all over the country. I think, interestingly, it's not that different from the way I typically teach. I think, you know, your theme for the discussion about voice is something that is really central to how we see education at Wesleyan. As a small women's college, one of the big things we really want to do is to have a place where our students come and find their own voice as they grow intellectually and in all kinds of ways to become better people. And so the partnership between IF and Wesleyan, ever since I attended the Institute, seemed like a really natural one, that we both seem interested in the same kind of goals for education.
So I'd love to hear more about this first year program that you have. But before we get to that, Wesleyan is celebrating the 175th anniversary this year, which is an amazing milestone for a women's college. Could you talk a little bit about the history of Wesleyan and, you know, what its mission has been and how you see that evolving?
Yes, Wesleyan is a really unusual place. It's a small women's college in Macon, Georgia. As our name suggests, we are affiliated with the Methodist Church. But the way the college started was that in 1836, some men leaders in the Methodist Church decided that women needed to be educated, which, you know, you can imagine what the culture of Macon, Georgia was like in 1836. It was a plantation society that had a lot of patriarchal values, but these men decided that women needed to be educated, and not just educated in decorative arts, but in the same kind of curriculum that men did. So they started a college where women learned science and languages and philosophy. Interestingly, one of the primary purposes that they had in doing that was to make women better mothers so they could educate their sons better. Wesleyan is the first college in the world to grant degrees to women. And so we're very proud of that history and have a proud tradition of being pioneers. That's our mascot. A number of Wesleyan graduates have done exceptional things, and we have a really strong alumna base that really helped shape even who we are today.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the WICE program? That WICE is short for, Jeff, can you help me? It's the
Wesleyan Integrated Seminar Experience.
Seminar Experience. Could you talk a little bit about what that program is and what changes that people can expect with this new
program? It's actually the Wesleyan Integrative Seminar Experience. Well, seminar. Yeah, the experience seminar. So Wesleyan Integrative Seminar. But that is our version of a first-year seminar that a lot of colleges and universities do. We are an interesting institution because we have some very high-achieving students, and then like a lot of places, we have a lot of first-generation students. We have a lot of students who are coming from limited academic backgrounds and limited economic means. And so what we try to do in that first semester is to both give them a kind of set of foundational skills that they're going to need in college, writing, critical thinking, and now with our IF partnership, we're going to be concentrating on communication. Also help them ease into a transition to college, because the move from secondary schools to higher education is increasingly difficult, to go from a kind of standardized test-based high school to a college that's asking them to create knowledge for themselves. So skills, transition, and then the other thing that we try to think about is, what does it mean to be educated? What's the value of going to a liberal arts college, a women's college? What do they want to get out of their education, and what are they going to do with it? Because so many students just go to college because it's the next expected step. And so we really want them in the first semester to stop and think about, okay, why am I here? What can I get out of this place? And what's the value of that going to be in my life?
You know, part of the challenge with the student-centered approach, or actually the opportunity maybe for the student-centered approach, is that it is a departure from traditional classrooms that are more sort of law and order, sit down, listen, sage on the stage approach to teaching. You know, given that your students come from such a variety and a diversity of backgrounds, I'd like us to talk a little bit about how our education helps them to get to that point. So you're talking about these are 18-year-olds that are coming. And recently in Education Week, there was an article that was released that talked about, the headline was U.S. pressured by international comparisons. And so there's a lot of discussion and comparisons to systems such as Finland, Singapore, and Japan, and lots of arguments about the United States falling behind. Allison, you work with school districts all over the country. What are some of the obstacles that you're seeing in speaking from family and students to preparing them to be able to be ready for this sort of approach that IF is using in the classroom?
One of the challenges that I see is that parents and students are not at the table. We work a lot of time with school districts and superintendents and school boards, and you know, we're talking to the adults in the building, and very rarely is there a conversation where students are included in the decision-making process. So I think that's one of the challenges that we see oftentimes. And when we take a moment and we stop and we listen to the students, what we hear from them is that, you know, high-stakes testing maybe doesn't make sense. And, you know, the age-only assessment for grade placement maybe doesn't make sense. And some of these draconian punishments for school uniform violations or, you know, disrespect or these kind of amorphous categories of behavior probably also don't make sense. And when we really begin to listen to the students and the families who are really the clients and the customers of the schools and the school districts, then we can incorporate their perspectives and really understand what it will take to be an efficient and effective model for education.
Jeff, do you think that this a sort of a student-centered approach, there could be some benefits of pushing it even downward, like before they get to Wesleyan?
I think so. I think that's one of the things that we've been interested in thinking about, how that could happen so that students get more exposed to this kind of, you could say, intellectual ownership of their education earlier on. And I think one of our interests as an organization is thinking for the future of education. And I would say a lot of our education policy is really looking to models of the past. You know, when you think of the whole standardized education approach and how it's becoming more and more about rote learning and, you know, the kind of answers that you could bubble in on a test, that's really, I would say, an outmoded notion of learning. And that I don't see how that really is going to be helping students become the idea generators or really exploratory thinkers and inventors of the next century. And so we're hopeful that this kind of a mind shift that we're proposing to be more interactive, more student-centered, could influence our vision of what education is about, get it out of this kind of, you know, standardized test hierarchy. And maybe if that's what's going on in college, maybe that could have an influence downward onto what's happening in K through 12.
Matt, you've been teaching freshmen for quite some time, and you said that you've used a lot of these student-centered teaching approaches in the past. How are the students reacting to it? I mean, are they making that transition from, you know, the type of learning that they experienced in high school? Are you seeing trouble with that transition?
Even though we're a really small women's college, we have a very diverse student body. About 20% of our students are international. About a quarter of our students are African American. We have a large number of first generation students, and then some students who come from elite backgrounds. And so we get a kind of confluence of a lot of the issues facing American education coming in through our doors. And it's this competing set of interests. Students come in wanting typically to get a college degree because they need a college degree to get a job. And that's an economic pressure that everybody understands and an expectation that we obviously don't want to ignore. And so they want to come in to get career certification. And then when they hear us say, we want you to think for yourself, we want you to come up with your own answers, there's understandably a lot of resistance among our students because that isn't the deal they've been given before. You know, they've been told in order to succeed, you take a body of knowledge and then, as Jeff says, you fill in bubbles on a test and then you get a diploma and then you can go out and get a job. And so it's a challenge to do that, but it is also, I think, very much an opportunity to be able to get people from literally all over the world and from all kinds of backgrounds in a classroom and to get them to be able to talk to each other about, okay, I'm here because that's the next step in my process, but why do I really want to be here? And to be honest, it doesn't work for everybody. Some students don't buy into it, but I think the ones who do really leave with a sense of feeling empowered and feeling a sense of wanting to engage with the world in more than just a kind of passive consumerist way.
You know, Matt, you touched on something very important, and I think that, you know, K-12 education as it is right now in traditional public schools is stifling. And I think that, you know, the instinct that children have to really voice their concerns and to really speak out for themselves and to really to experiment with their voice as they're beginning to learn about the world around them is really being tamped down by, you know, some of the policies that we impose on them and the testing that we impose on them. And so where we see student voice in K-12, we're seeing it in terms of, you know, protests of, you know, terrible facilities or racial disparities in student discipline, and not necessarily in the way that, you know, I think Jeff and If have really expressed, which is to begin to nurture this instinct to really begin to engage with one another and explore ideas and to be creative in the classroom with their voice.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure.
Here. So with a student-centered, you know, especially if you talk to some of the old school folks, like my mom, plain talker, right? Kids don't necessarily know a lot. And in fact, I don't know a lot in comparison to what she knows because, you know, I might have this little BlackBerry where I can get access to like everything that's in like 50 million dictionaries in like 2 seconds. But that doesn't mean I know anything. It doesn't mean that I am in a position to be able to say what policies should be there, should say what the lessons should be there. So how do you sort of like balance that need to nurture this curiosity and this creativity and giving them the tools to be able to analyze things with the fact that they actually don't know anything?
Right. I think it's perfectly possible to integrate what we're talking about together with some kind of knowledge acquisition. And that, let's say you're exploring some topic in class, students will learn that there are some knowledge gaps that they need to fill in. So there's things, and that's where their research comes in. So we're not saying that knowledge acquisition isn't important, but we are saying that this whole model of the student is basically a passive recipient of knowledge, that is outmoded. And that's not a good way to prepare the next generation, whether we're thinking of the next generation of employees or the next generation of scientists or artists, or there are skills that we're talking about that really go to the vitality of any endeavor that students will go on to.
I totally agree with that. As a crotchety old professor, you know, we love to sit around and talk about how little students know now. And, I mean, and it's a genuine issue. But I think Jeff is right. And I'm an English professor. And so the tremendous revolution that we're seeing in technology and information is, in a sense, challenging to the very nature of what I do, because, you know, I grew up teaching people to read novels, and reading novels is something that students have less and less tolerance for, because it's just not the way information is conveyed as much anymore. So how we balance students being able to be engaged and active and finding their voice with an understanding and, you know, credo that all information is not the same, and that just being able to say whatever you think does not mean that you're educated. So we're working very hard in thinking about including the if process in our first year class. How do we challenge students to have their own voice, but also to deepen that voice, mm-hmm. to think in new ways, to take in new information. So tying student-facilitated discussions with specific texts that they read and talk about the specifics of what's in that text and what it might mean as a way to deepen the conversation is a challenge we take very seriously.
We're not talking about relinquishing all control to students and allowing students to make every final decision. I think, you know, in terms of, for instance, international pressures on, you know, educational success in this country, it is impossible to have that conversation without considering 2012, what students are experiencing. And I think that there's an inclination on the part of grown folks to say, you know, we've been there before. We know what it's like to be a child. We know what it's like to be a student. We can speak for them because they don't know anything. And I think that's a dangerous approach. And without including the student voice at the table and allowing them to participate in the conversation, then we'll continue to be mediocre.
Well, and I would just add to that that I think the great strength of the American higher education system was its creativity and was its emphasis on innovation, that was really what we brought to the table. And I think that we run a risk of losing that if we make secondary education and K-12 education increasingly based on these standardized tests that are about quantums of data. So I think we're really undermining one of the great strengths of the American education system.
You know, one of the other headlines that we saw recently in the New York Times, there was where the charter school debate is one of these areas where this debate over innovation is sort of playing out. And Mayor Bloomberg recently announced a plan to close one charter school for mediocre performance. And they did this in saying that this school was right in the middle of the pack, and it's in Queens, and they decided to close it down to sort of send a message that mediocrity isn't accepted in charter, and they're going to hold them to higher standards. And this was all based on standardized tests. So I don't know how far afield we are going with our debate about innovation, but I wondered if you, either Jeff, Allison, Matt, either of you have any thoughts about this.
First of all, if we were to close every mediocre school in this country, I'm afraid for where our children would be. But also, you know, again, when you talk about student voice, I'm betting that if you went into that school and you interviewed students about whether they were safe, whether they felt comfortable, whether they enjoyed their experience, I'm betting that you would find some children that really did enjoy their experience. And there may be ways to really, you know, beef up the academic program or something like that. But, you know, when you rely, that's the danger of relying solely on numbers and solely on these tests that don't incorporate student perspective, then you end up kind of making these arbitrary decisions that are difficult to justify and make no sense and leave children hanging with no recourse.
So much of that depends on what are the outcomes that you're looking for. I'm all for evaluating what we do, because you want to be able to learn from your experiences and figure out in education what's working. But if your only measures are these high-stakes standardized tests, I just think there's no indication that those are really the measures of a truly successful education. So what I'm hopeful for with our approach is that we're going to be, at least in this higher education context initially, expanding people's sense of what are the things that we want to look for students to be developing, and what are the things that they really need to be successful looking ahead into the 21st century, rather than what did it take to be successful 50 years ago.
You know, when Matt was talking about his students, And actually, this applies to majority of students who are thinking about going into higher education. You know, there is increasingly this transactional approach to it. I earn this degree that gets me this job. It's not necessarily about the process or the journey or the engaging in anything. And it's sort of like, I do this, you give me that. And so they're sort of very focused on, you know, those outcomes. So I think it even kind of seeps down into them. And maybe in the way we're even talking to them, you have to do really well on this test or else, right. or else, and then you can get to this. And then, you know, and so this is a sort of thing that's sort of pushing all the way up in our society. And IF actually has a wonderful report that should probably be out in the next month or so on the future of higher education. And Jeff, you're more familiar with this than I am, but it does address some of these competing ways of looking at, should higher education be career training? Should we not focus? Should we shift the focus very early on in someone's education and steer them toward certain trades? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
That report came out of a collaboration with Tim Steffensmeyer at Kansas State University. And essentially, he drew together two panels out there. One, a group of people who had specialized in some part of higher education, and then a group of local citizens. And independently at first, and then together when they met jointly, they developed some alternative possibilities looking at the future of higher ed. But one of the big themes of their discussion was, what is the relationship of a higher education degree and successful participation in the economy? And, you know, one possibility is just to see education as essentially employment training. And so maybe we want to fine tune it to what are the demands of employment. Now, I'm not arguing for that view and may not even want to approve of it myself, but I would say this, that one of the things that you might think about with this process is thinking about what are the communication skills or the thinking skills or the social skills that students are going to need as they go forward into the world of employment. It's not so much a body of knowledge that they're going to need. That's constantly changing. And so to think that you're going to learn in those 4 years of college everything that you'd need to know in your employment career, that's no longer a tenable idea. But if it's the ability to work together with others as a team, if it's ability to help a group be creative and discover new content or new perspectives, if it's the higher order thinking skill of being able to summarize what a group is doing, often with its disparate voices, and then articulate those ideas, I mean, those are all skills that you don't lose. You know, knowledge comes and goes, the information you need will change, but those skills are things that you keep forever. Even if you don't want to adopt that employment training view of education, I think you could say this approach does address some of those concerns.
In being a liberal arts college, I think we very much believe in the life of the mind and the value of academics for their own sakes, but we also very much believe that the kind of learning you do in a liberal arts environment where you are not just getting a specific training for one kind of set of information for a career, but where you're learning how to think, you're learning how to write, you're learning how to express yourself, really gives you the best set of skills that you can take into the work environment. And that is increasingly going to become important as our world changes at an ever-increasing pace. But the other thing that I wanted to say is, as a parent who has three children in the Macon public school system, a school system that is incredibly challenged by high levels of poverty and high levels of students coming from very challenged backgrounds in all kinds of ways, I think the challenges facing higher education system in America are enormous, and that we should not gloss over them, and that we've had a lot of experiences with public school teachers working in very difficult circumstances who are really doing heroic jobs to try to give our students the best education they can. And so I think what we're saying is exactly right about needs to change, but I think we also have to acknowledge the incredible obstacles that are in our social system, in our economic system, in our political system that make it very difficult to achieve those changes.
And in our legal system as well. Allison, can you speak a little bit about, you know, as an education attorney and you're dealing with the policies and the rules that govern everyone around the country, what are some of the things that you're seeing, speaking to his point about the public system in Macon?
I am all over the country, and I see a variety of different school districts, small and large and rural and urban. But I think they all struggle with this question of how to, with the imposition of standardized testing and federal regulation and all of these obligations, how to really allow children to be children. And I think we've come to a point where children are being criminalized in our schools. We're at a point where children, if they can't succeed or do well on a standardized test, they're being pushed out of the classroom and into, you know, these alternative school warehouses. And what I am seeing is troubling. And I think that the adults involved in the system are also troubled. And I think that no one is necessarily intentionally acting against children this way. And I think that, you know, there is a system in place that is really compelling adults to try to focus on outcomes much more than focusing on the experience for children. And I think that, you know, the beauty of what IF and Wesleyan are doing is really to encourage and teach thought. You know, I will say something positive about my law school experience, and that is that there was no real discussion of outcomes for classes. You know, so you went into your class and you went through the Socratic method and you were taught to really engage with the process and engage with the cases and engage with one another in a way that was very, very new for a lot of people, because we had so been accustomed to, I need an A in this class, and what formula do I need to plug in order to get the A in this class? And, you know, with one exam at the end of the semester, you really, in law school, are focused more on the conversation and the process of pulling perspectives, and that is not happening in K-12 education today.
Just listening to Allison, I do think that there is tremendous hope and potential in that. Young people still today very much want to learn. They still are inquisitive. They still care about their world and about their future. Right before we had this conversation, I was teaching my senior seminar for English majors, which is a class designed to have all the English majors in their last semester of college do a big senior project and also get together and talk about what their education has meant to them and where they go from here. And so the way I started the conversation was by saying, imagine that you were going on a podcast and you were going to talk about Wesley and its history and what its education means. What would you say? And what came out of it was not, from my perspective, not so much the details of what they said, but the process of what they said. That these were young women who were engaged in thinking about their position at the institution of Wesleyan and the larger world, and they really cared and had an active voice in trying to put together the past with their future and thinking about what's working well at this college and what's not. And they left energized with the sense that maybe even right now they could change some of the policies that are going on in the college to make it better. And so just that metaphor of a small group of women coming together to be able to deliberate something in an open way and to come to conclusions for themselves is exactly what we wanted Wesleyan education to be, and what we're trying to start off our first year experience with. That we want them to know from the minute they set foot on campus that that's the kind of place we are, that we're a place where their voice matters, where developing your voice is important, and where working things out among your peers is the way to become educated.
Sounds wonderful. I would have loved to have been in that classroom. So what kinds of changes can first-year students at Wesleyan expect in the fall of 2012 when this partnership kicks off between IF and your program? Matt and Jeff, do you have anything else to add?
Sure. Just to fill people in on how this will develop, Matt, together with his colleague Deirdre Donmoyer and Lisa Rouleau, they'll be working with the faculty team there to develop the course this spring. So they're going to be meeting really starting, I think, the 18th of this month to put together what this new course will be like, how it will integrate the student-centered discussion process. So they'll be developing it all this spring. Then in the summer, some of us from IF will go down there and help them actually practice it so that they see this is what it's like for the students facilitating a discussion. Here's what it's like to evaluate or give feedback on that facilitation. Here's how the course will develop over the course of the semester so that they'll have more of a hands-on sense of what it's like. And then the course will go live in the fall. And the reason why it's a two-year project is that half that team of faculty will teach it in the first year. and then half of them will teach it in the second year. So we're basically teaching all the faculty how to do this, but some of them, it's like a year-on, year-off rotation. So there'll be some of them actually doing it now and then some doing it in 2013.
I think one of the great things about how IF tries to have faculty have these experiences is that they actually experience it. I've gone to a lot of teaching workshops that are about new pedagogy where you sit and see a PowerPoint presentation on the new pedagogy and passively listen to the whole thing, which seems to be defeating the whole point. It seems like people would have more insight into that. But IF doesn't do that. What they ask you to do, instead of telling you about a bunch of things you're supposed to do, they want you to actually experience it. And that's exactly what we're going to be trying to do this summer with the Wesleyan faculty, is have them go through these experiences themselves so they can understand the kind of experiences students will have and the kind of potential and challenges of doing that. So I'm really excited about that.
Wonderful. Well, as this program evolves, I hope to have you all back on the podcast. And so we can sort of catch up on how things are going and, you know, lessons learned. And Jeff, did you have something else to add?
I was just going to say that if people listening to this are interested in learning more about what this approach is like, we have a number of resources available on our interactivityfoundation.org website. If you look under the guidebooks, you'll find a student's guidebook to student-centered discussion. We're also tangential to our website, are developing a wiki space website that has some guidelines for student-centered discussions in the classroom. And a lot of those entries now have been, if not created by, they have been revised by students who have actually gone through this discussion process. So that guide is really becoming more a peer-to-peer or student-to-student guide of, here's how you do this in the classroom. Here are some problems that might come up when you're facilitating. Here's how you deal with a lazy person who's not contributing. So all kinds of hands-on tips about how to do this. If people are interested, they can find it by going to our website.
And even if you're not in the education system, also want to put another plug in for our discussion guides. We've got the future of K-12 education, and that's been one of the most popular recent discussion guides that we've had. We have people organizing groups all over the country discussing, engaging with a lot of these issues, as well as the future of higher education report that is forthcoming, like I said, in the next few weeks or so. This has been the IF Podcast, and joining me in the studio has been Allison Brown, an education lawyer based in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Allison.
Thank you for having me, Natalie.
And on the phone from Macon, Georgia, we have Matt Martin, a professor of English at Wesleyan College. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And, of course, in the Washington, D.C. studio, we also have Jeff Prudhomme, vice president of the Interactivity Foundation. Thanks for coming out, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Natalie.
And I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Thanks for joining us.